phrase. Noun phrase consists of determiner, adjective, noun. Verb phrase consists of verb, noun phrase. Dog, noun. Ice cream, noun. Ate, verb. Eater is the subject, thing eaten is the object. The, determiner. Big, adjective. This hypothetical time-lapse photography of the mind of a child at work shows how a child, if suitably equipped, could learn three rules and five words from a single sentence in context. The use of part of speech categories, X-bar phrase structure, and meaning guessed from context is amazingly powerful. But amazing power is what a real-life child needs to learn grammar so quickly, especially without parental feedback. There are many benefits to using a small number of innate categories like noun and verb to organize incoming speech. By calling both the subject and object phrases noun phrase rather than, say, phrase number one and phrase number two, the child automatically can apply hard-won knowledge about nouns in subject position to nouns in object position, and vice versa. For example, our model child can already generalize and use dog as an object without having heard an adult do so. And the child tacitly knows that adjectives precede nouns not just in subjects but in objects, again, without direct evidence. The child knows that if more than one dog is dogs in subject position, more than one dog is dogs in object position. I conservatively estimate that English allows about 8 possible phrase mates of a head noun inside a noun phrase, such as John's dog, dogs in the park, big dogs, dogs that I like, and so on. In turn, there are about 8 places in a sentence where the whole noun phrase can go, such as dog bites man, man bites dog, a dog's life. Give the boy a dog. Talk to the dog. And so on. There are 3 ways to inflect a noun. Dog, dogs, dogs possessive. And a typical child by the time he or she is in high school has learned something like 20,000 nouns. If children had to learn all the combinations separately, they would need to listen to about 140 million different sentences. At a rate of a sentence every 10 seconds, 10 hours a day, it would take over a century. But by unconsciously labeling all nouns as N and all noun phrases as NP, the child is only to hear about 25 different kinds of noun phrase and learn the nouns one by one, and the millions of possible combinations become available automatically. Indeed, if children are blinkered to look for only a small number of phrase types, they automatically gain the ability to produce an infinite number of sentences, one of the quintessential properties of human grammar. Take the phrase, the tree in the park. If the child mentally labels the park as a noun phrase, and also labels the tree in the park as a noun phrase, the resulting rules generate a noun phrase inside a prepositional phrase inside a noun phrase, a loop that can be iterated indefinitely, as in the tree near the ledge by the lake and the park and the city in the east of the state. In contrast, a child who was free to label in the park as one kind of phrase and the tree in the park as another kind would be deprived of the insight that the phrase contains an example of itself. The child would be limited to reproducing that phrase structure alone. Mental flexibility confines children. Innate constraints set them free. Once a rudimentary but roughly accurate analysis of sentence structure has been set up, the rest of the language can fall into place. Abstract words, nouns that do not refer to objects and people, for example, can be learned by paying attention to where they sit inside a sentence. Since situation in the situation justifies drastic measures occurs inside a phrase in noun phrase position, it must be a noun. If the language allows phrases to be scrambled around the sentence like Latin or Warlpiri, The child can discover this feature upon coming across a word that cannot be connected to a tree in the expected place without crossing branches. The child, constrained by universal grammar, knows what to focus on in decoding case and agreement inflections. A noun's inflection might depend on whether it is in subject or object position. A verb's might depend on tense, aspect, and the number, person, and gender of its subject and object. If the hypotheses were not confined to this small set, the task of learning inflections would be intractable. Logically speaking, an inflection could depend on whether the third word in the sentence referred to a reddish or bluish object, whether the last word was long or short, whether the sentence was being uttered indoors or outdoors, and billions of other fruitless possibilities that a grammatically unfettered child would have to test for. We can now return to the puzzle that opened the chapter. Why aren't babies born talking? We know that part of the answer is that babies have to listen to themselves to learn how to work their articulators, and have to listen to their elders to learn communal phonemes, words, and phrase orders. Some of these acquisitions depend on other ones, forcing development to proceed in a sequence, phonemes before words, words before sentences. But any mental mechanism powerful enough to learn these things could probably do so within a few weeks or months of input. Why does the sequence have to take 3 years? Could it be any faster? Perhaps not. Complicated machines take time to assemble, and human infants may be expelled from the womb before their brains are complete. A human, after all, is an animal with a ludicrously large head, and a woman's pelvis, through which it must pass, can be only so big. If human beings stayed in the womb for the proportion of their life cycle that we would expect based on extrapolation from other primates, they would be born at the age of 18 months. That is the age at which babies, in fact, begin to put words together. In one sense, then, babies are born talking. And we know that babies' brains do change considerably after birth. Before birth, virtually all the neurons, nerve cells, are formed, and they migrate into their proper locations in the brain. But head size, brain weight, and thickness of the cerebral cortex, gray matter, where the synapses, junctions, subserving mental computation are found, continue to increase rapidly in the year after birth. Long-distance connections, white matter, are not complete until 9 months, and they continue to grow their speed-inducing myelin insulation throughout childhood. Synapses continue to develop, peaking in number between 9 months and 2 years, depending on the brain region, at which point the child has 50% more synapses than the adult. Metabolic activity in the brain reaches adult levels by 9 to 10 months, and soon exceeds it, peaking around the age of 4. The brain is sculpted not only by adding neural material, but by chipping it away. Massive numbers of neurons die in utero, and the dying continues during the first 2 years before leveling off at age 7. Synapses wither from the age of 2 through the rest of childhood and into adolescence, when the brain's metabolic rate falls back to adult levels. Language development, then, could be on a maturational timetable, like teeth. Perhaps linguistic accomplishments like babbling, first words, and grammar require minimum levels of brain size, long-distance connections, and extra synapses, particularly in the language centers of the brain, which we will explore in the next chapter. So language seems to develop about as quickly as the growing brain can handle it. What's the rush? Why is language installed so quickly while the rest of the child's mental development seems to proceed at a more leisurely pace? In a book on evolutionary theory, often considered to be one of the most important since Darwin's, the biologist George Williams speculates, "We might imagine that Hans and Fritz Faustkeil are told on Monday, 'Don't go near the water,' and that both go wading and are spanked for it. On Tuesday they are told, 'Don't play near the fire,' and again they disobey and are spanked. On Wednesday they are told, 'Don't tease the saber tooth.' This time, Hans understands the message and he bears firmly in mind the consequences of disobedience. He prudently avoids the saber tooth and escapes the spanking. Poor Fritz escapes the spanking too, but for a very different reason. Even today, accidental death is an important cause of mortality in early life, and parents who consistently spare the rod in other matters may be moved to violence when a child plays with electric wires or chases a ball into the street. Many of the accidental deaths of small children would probably have been avoided if the victims had understood and remembered verbal instructions and had been capable of effectively substituting verbal symbols for real experience. This might well have been true also under primitive conditions. Perhaps it is no coincidence that the vocabulary spurt and beginnings of grammar follow closely on the heels of the baby. Quite literally, the ability to walk unaccompanied appears around 15 months. Let's complete our exploration of the linguistic life cycle. Everyone knows that it is much more difficult to learn a second language in adulthood than a first language in childhood. Most adults never master a foreign language, especially the phonology, hence the ubiquitous foreign accent. Their development often fossilizes into permanent error patterns that no teaching or correction can undo. Of course, there are great individual differences which depend on effort, attitudes, amount of exposure, quality of teaching, and plain talent. But there seems to be a cap even for the best adults in the best circumstances. The actress Meryl Streep is renowned in the United States for her seemingly convincing accents, but I am told that in England her British accent in Plenty was considered rather awful, and that her Australian accent in the movie about the dingo that ate the baby didn't go over too well down there either. Many explanations have been advanced for children's superiority. They exploit mother ease, make errors unselfconsciously, are more motivated to communicate, like to conform, are not yet xenophobic or set in their ways, and have no first language to interfere. But some of these accounts are unlikely, based on what we know about how language acquisition works. For example, children can learn a language without standard mother ease. They make few errors, and they get no feedback for the errors they do make. In any case, recent evidence is calling these social and motivational explanations into doubt. Holding every other factor constant, a key factor stands out. Sheer age. People who immigrate after puberty provide some of the most compelling examples, even the apparent success stories. A few highly talented and motivated individuals master much of the grammar of a foreign language, but not its sound pattern. Henry Kissinger, who immigrated to the United States as a teenager, retains a frequently satirized German accent. His brother, a few years younger, has no accent. Ukrainian-born Joseph Conrad, whose first language was Polish, is considered one of the best writers in English in this century, but his accent was so thick his friends could barely understand him. Even the adults who succeed at grammar often depend on the conscious exercise of their considerable intellects, unlike children, to whom language acquisition just happens. Vladimir Nabokov, another brilliant writer in English, refused to lecture or be interviewed extemporaneously, insisting on writing out every word beforehand with the help of dictionaries and grammars. As he modestly explained, "I think like a genius, I write like a distinguished author, and I speak like a child." And he had the benefit of being raised in part by an English-speaking nanny. More systematic evidence comes from the psychologist Elisa Newport and her colleagues. They tested Korean and Chinese-born students and faculty at the University of Illinois, who had spent at least 10 years in the United States. The immigrants were given a list of 276 simple English sentences, half of them containing some grammatical error like, "The farmer bought two pig," or "The little boy is speak to a policeman." The errors were errors with respect to the spoken vernacular, not proper written prose. The immigrants who came to the United States between the ages of 3 and 7 performed identically to American-born students. Those who arrived between the ages of 8 and 15 did increasingly worse the later they arrived, and those who arrived between 17 and 39 did the worst of all, and showed huge variability unrelated to their age of arrival. What about acquisition of the mother tongue? Cases in which people make it to puberty without having learned a language are rare, but they all point to the same conclusion. We saw in Chapter 2 that deaf people who are not exposed to sign language until adulthood never do as well as those who learned it as children. Among the wolf children who are found in the woods or in the homes of psychotic parents after puberty, some develop words, and some, like Jeannie, discovered in 1970 at the age of 13 and a half in a Los Angeles suburb, learn to produce immature, pigeon-like sentences. Mike paint. Applesauce buy store. Neil come happy. Neil not come sad. Jeannie have mama have baby grow up. I like elephant eat peanut. But they are permanently incapable of mastering the full grammar of the language. In contrast, one child, Isabel, was 6 and a half when she and her mute, brain-damaged mother escaped from the silent imprisonment of her grandfather's house. A year and a half later, she had acquired 1,500 to 2,000 words and produced complex grammatical sentences like, "Why does the paste come out if one upsets the jar? What did Miss Mason say when you told her I cleaned my classroom? Do you go to Miss Mason's school at the university?" Obviously, she was well on her way to learning English as successfully as anyone else. The tender age at which she began made all the difference. With unsuccessful learners like Jeannie, there is always a suspicion that the sensory deprivation and emotional scars sustained during the horrific confinement somehow interfered with their ability to learn. But recently, a striking case of first language acquisition in a normal adult has surfaced. Chelsea was born deaf in a remote town in Northern California. A series of inept doctors and clinicians diagnosed her as retarded to emotionally disturbed without recognizing her deafness, a common fate for many deaf children in the past. She grew up shy, dependent, and languageless, but otherwise emotionally and neurologically normal, sheltered by a loving family who never believed she was retarded. At the age of 31, she was referred to an astonished neurologist who had her fitted with hearing aids that improved her hearing to near normal levels. Intensive therapy by a rehabilitative team has brought her to a point where she scores at a 10-year-old level on intelligence tests, knows 2,000 words, holds a job in a veterinarian's office, reads, writes, communicates, and has become social and independent. She has only one problem, which becomes apparent as soon as she opens her mouth. The small A the hat. Richard eat peppers hot. Orange Tim car in. Banana the eat. I wanda be drive come. The boat sits water on. Breakfast eating girl. Combing hair the boy. The woman is bus the going. The girl is cone the ice cream shopping buying the man. Despite intensive training and impressive gains in other spheres, Chelsea's syntax is bizarre. In sum, acquisition of a normal language is guaranteed for children up to the age of 6, is steadily compromised from then until shortly after puberty, and is rare thereafter. Maturational changes in the brain, such as the decline in metabolic rate and number of neurons during the early school age years, and the bottoming out of the number of synapses and metabolic rate around puberty, are plausible cases. We do know that the language learning circuitry of the brain is more plastic in childhood. Children learn or recover language when the left hemisphere of the brain is damaged or even surgically removed, though not quite at normal levels, but comparable damage in an adult usually leads to permanent aphasia. Critical periods for specific kinds of learning are common in the animal kingdom. There are windows in development in which ducklings learn to follow large moving objects. Kittens' visual neurons become tuned to vertical, horizontal, and oblique lines, and white-crowned sparrows duplicate their father's songs. But why should learning ever decline and fall? Why throw away such a useful skill? Critical periods seem paradoxical, but only because most of us have an incorrect understanding of the biology of organisms' life histories. We tend to think that genes are like the blueprints in a factory, and organisms are like the appliances that the factory turns out. Our picture is that during gestation, when the organism is built, it is permanently fitted with the parts it will carry throughout its lifetime. Children and teenagers and adults and old people have arms and legs and a heart because arms and legs and a heart were part of the infant's factory-installed equipment. When a part vanishes for no reason, we are puzzled. But now try to think of the life cycle in a different way. Imagine that what the genes control is not a factory sending appliances into the world, but a machine shop in a thrifty theater company to which props and sets and materials periodically return to be dismantled and reassembled for the next production. At any point, different contraptions can come out of the shop depending on current need. The most obvious biological illustration is metamorphosis. In insects, the genes build an eating machine, let it grow, build a container around it, dissolve it into a puddle of nutrients, and recycle them into a breeding machine. Even in humans, the sucking reflex disappears, teeth erupt twice, and a suite of secondary sexual characteristics emerge in a maturational schedule. Now complete the mental backflip. Think of metamorphosis and maturational emergence not as the exception, but as the rule. The genes, shaped by natural selection, control bodies throughout the lifespan. Designs hang around during the times of life when they are useful, not before or after. The reason that we have arms at age 60 is not because they have stuck around since birth, but because arms are as useful to a 60-year-old as they were to a baby. This inversion, an exaggeration but a useful one, flips the critical period question with it. The question is no longer, why does a learning ability disappear, but when is the learning ability needed? We have already noted that the answer might be, as early as possible, to allow the benefits of language to be enjoyed for as much of life as possible. Now note that learning a language, as opposed to using a language, is perfectly useful as a one-shot skill. Once the details of the local language have been acquired from the surrounding adults, any further ability to learn, aside from vocabulary, is superfluous. It is like borrowing a floppy disk drive to load a new computer with the software you will need, or borrowing a turntable to copy your old collection of LPs onto tape. Once you are done, the machines can be returned. So language acquisition circuitry is not needed once it has been used. It should be dismantled if keeping it around incurs any costs. And it probably does incur costs. Metabolically, the brain is a pig. It consumes a fifth of the body's oxygen and similarly large portions of its calories and phospholipids. Greedy neural tissue lying around beyond its point of usefulness is a good candidate for the recycling bin. James Herford, the world's only computational evolutionary linguist, has put these kinds of assumptions into a computer simulation of evolving humans and finds that a critical period for language acquisition centered in early childhood is the inevitable outcome. Even if there is some utility to our learning a second language as adults, the critical period for language acquisition may have evolved as part of a larger fact of life, the increasing feebleness and vulnerability with advancing age that biologists call senescence. Common sense says that the body, like all machines, must wear out with use, but this is another misleading implication of the appliance metaphor. Organisms are self-replenishing, self-repairing systems, and there is no physical reason why we should not be biologically immortal, as in fact lineages of cancer cells used in laboratory research are. That would not mean that we would actually be immortal. Every day there is a certain probability that we will fall off a cliff, catch a virulent disease, be struck by lightning, or be murdered by a rival, and sooner or later one of those lightning bolts or bullets will have our name on it. The question is every day a lottery in which the odds of drawing a fatal ticket are the same, or do the odds get worse and worse the longer we play? Senescence is the bad news that the odds do change. Elderly people are killed by falls and flus that their grandchildren easily survive. A major question in modern evolutionary biology is why this should be true, given that selection operates at every point of an organism's life history. Why aren't we built to be equally hale and hearty every day of our lives so that we can pump out copies of ourselves indefinitely? The solution from George Williams and P.B. Medawar is ingenious. As natural selection designed organisms, it must have been faced with countless choices among features that involved different trade-offs of costs and benefits at different ages. Some materials might be strong and light, but wear out quickly, whereas others might be heavier but more durable. Some biochemical processes might deliver excellent products, but leave a legacy of accumulating pollution within the body. There might be a metabolically expensive cellular repair mechanism that comes in most useful late in life when wear and tear have accumulated. What does natural selection do when faced with these trade-offs? In general, it will favor an option with benefits to the young organism and costs to the old one over an option with the same average benefit spread out evenly over the lifespan. This asymmetry is rooted in the inherent asymmetry of death. If a lightning bolt kills a 40-year-old, there will be no 50-year-old or 60-year-old to worry about, but there will have been a 20-year-old and a 30-year-old. Any bodily feature designed for the benefit of the potential over 40 incarnations at the expense of the under 40 incarnations will have gone to waste. And the logic is the same for unforeseeable death at any age. The brute mathematical fact is that all things being equal, there is a better chance of being a young person than being an old person. So genes that strengthen young organisms at the expense of old organisms have the odds in their favor and will tend to accumulate over evolutionary time spans, whatever the body system, and the result is overall senescence. Thus, language acquisition might be like other biological functions. The linguistic clumsiness of tourists and students might be the price we pay for the linguistic genius we displayed as babies, just as the decrepitude of age is the price we pay for the vigor of youth. Chapter 10. Language Organs and Grammar Genes. Ability to learn grammar laid to gene by researcher. This 1992 headline appeared not in a supermarket tabloid, but in an Associated Press news story, based on a report at the annual meeting of the Principal Scientific Association in the United States. The report had summarized evidence that specific language impairment runs in families, focusing on the British family we met in Chapter 2, in which the inheritance pattern is particularly clear. The syndicated columnists James J. Kilpatrick and Irma Bombeck were incredulous. Kilpatrick's column began, "Better Grammar Through Genetics." Researchers made a stunning announcement the other day at a meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Are you ready? Genetic biologists have identified the grammar gene. Yes. It appears from a news account that Steven Pinker of MIT and Myrna Gopnik of McGill University have solved a puzzle that has baffled teachers of English for years. Some pupils master grammar with no more than a few moans of protest. Others, given the same instruction, persist in saying that Susie invited her and I to the party. It is all a matter of heredity. This we can handle. A single dominant gene, the biologists believe, controls the ability to learn grammar. A child who says, "Them marbles is mine," is not necessarily stupid. He has all his marbles. The child is simply a little short on chromosomes. It boggles the mind. Before long, the researchers will isolate the gene that controls spelling. The column continues. Neatness. The read-a-book gene. A gene to turn down the boombox. Another to turn off the TV. Politeness. Chores. Homework. Bombeck wrote, "Poor grammar? It are in the genes." It was not much of a surprise to read that kids who are unable to learn grammar are missing a dominant gene. At one time in his career, my husband taught high school English. He had 37 grammar gene deficients in his class at one time. What do you think the odds of that happening are? They didn't have a clue where they were. A comma could have been a petroglyph. A subjective compliment was something you said to a friend when her hair came out right. A dangling participle was not their problem. Where is that class of young people today, you ask? They are all major sports figures, rock stars, and television personalities who make millions spewing out words such as bummer, radical, and awesome, and thinking they are complete sentences. The syndicated columns, third-hand newspaper stories, editorial cartoons, and radio shows following the symposium gave me a quick education about how scientific discoveries get addled by journalists working under deadline pressure. To set the record straight, the discovery of the family with the inherited language disorder belongs to Gopnik. The reporter who generously shared the credit with me was confused by the fact that I chaired the session and thus introduced Gopnik to the audience. No grammar gene was identified. A defective gene was inferred from the way the syndrome runs in the family. A single gene is thought to disrupt grammar, but that does not mean a single gene controls grammar. Removing the distributor wire prevents a car from moving, but that does not mean a car is controlled by its distributor wire. And, of course, what is disrupted is the ability to converse normally in everyday English, not the ability to learn the standard written dialect in school. But even when they know the facts, many people share the columnist's incredulity. Could there really be a gene tied to something as specific as grammar? The very idea is an assault on the deeply rooted belief that the brain is a general-purpose learning device, void and without form prior to experience of the surrounding culture. And if there are grammar genes, what do they do? Build the grammar organ, presumably? A metaphor from Chomsky that many find just as preposterous. But if there is a language instinct, it has to be embodied somewhere in the brain, and those brain circuits must have been prepared for their role by the genes that built them. What kind of evidence could show that there are genes that build parts of brains that control grammar? The ever-expanding toolkit of the geneticist and neurobiologist is mostly useless. Most people do not want their brains impaled by electrodes, injected with chemicals, rearranged by surgery, or removed for slicing and staining. As Woody Allen said, "The brain is my second favorite organ." So the biology of language remains poorly understood. But accidents of nature and ingenious indirect techniques have allowed neurolinguists to learn a surprising amount. Let's try to home in on the putative grammar gene, beginning with a bird's-eye view of the brain and zooming in on smaller and smaller components. We can narrow down our search at the outset by throwing away half the brain. In 1861, the French physician Paul Broca dissected the brain of an aphasic patient who had been nicknamed Tan by hospital workers, because that was the only syllable he uttered. Broca discovered a large cyst producing a lesion in Tan's left hemisphere. The next 8 cases of aphasia he observed also had left hemisphere lesions, too many to be attributed to chance. Broca concluded that the faculty for articulate language resides in the left hemisphere. In the 130 years since, Broca's conclusion has been confirmed by many kinds of evidence. Some of it comes from the convenient fact that the right half of the body and of perceptual space is controlled by the left hemisphere of the brain and vice versa. Many people with aphasia suffer weakness or paralysis on the right side, including Tan, and the recovered aphasic of Chapter 2, who awoke thinking that he had slept on his right arm. The link is summed up in Psalm 137, verses 5 through 6. If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Normal people recognize words more accurately when the words are flashed to the right side of their visual field than when they are flashed to the left, even when the language is Hebrew, which is written from right to left. When different words are presented simultaneously to the two ears, the person can make out the word coming into the right ear better. In some cases of otherwise incurable epilepsy, surgeons disconnect the two cerebral hemispheres by cutting the bundle of fibers running between them. After surgery, the patients live completely normal lives, except for a subtlety discovered by the neuroscientist Michael Gazzaniga. When the patients are kept still, they can describe events taking place in their right visual field and can name objects in their right hand, but cannot describe events taking place in their left visual field or name objects placed in their left hand. Though the right hemisphere can display its awareness of those events by nonverbal means like gesturing and pointing, the left half of their world has been disconnected from their language center. When neuroscientists look directly at the brain using a variety of techniques, they can actually see language in action in the left hemisphere. The anatomy of the normal brain, its bulges and creases, is slightly asymmetrical. In some of the regions associated with language, the differences are large enough to be seen with the naked eye. Computerized axial tomography, CT or CAT, and magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, use a computer algorithm to reconstruct a picture of the living brain in cross-section. Aphasics brains almost always show lesions in the left hemisphere. Neurologists can temporarily paralyze one hemisphere by injecting sodium amytal into the carotid artery. A patient with a sleeping right hemisphere can talk. A patient with a sleeping left hemisphere cannot. During brain surgery, patients can remain conscious under local anesthetic because the brain has no pain receptors. The neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield found that small electric shocks to certain parts of the left hemisphere could silence the patient in mid-sentence. Neurosurgeons do these manipulations not out of curiosity, but to be sure that they are not cutting out vital parts of the brain along with the diseased ones. In a technique used on normal research subjects, electrodes are pasted all over the scalp, and the subject's electroencephalograms, EEGs, are recorded as they read or hear words. There are recognizable jumps in the electrical signal that are synchronized with each word, and they are more prominent in the electrodes pasted on the left side of the skull than in those on the right. Though this finding is tricky to interpret because an electrical signal generated deep in one part of the brain can radiate out of another part. In a new technique called positron emission tomography, PET, a volunteer is injected with mildly radioactive glucose or water, or inhales a radioactive gas comparable in dosage to a chest X-ray, and puts his head inside a ring of gamma ray detectors. The parts of the brain that are more active burn more glucose and have more oxygenated blood sent their way. Computer algorithms can reconstruct which parts of the brain are working harder from the pattern of radiation that emanates from the head. An actual picture of metabolic activity within a slice of the brain can be displayed in a computer-generated photograph, with the more active areas showing up in bright reds and yellows, the quiet areas in dark indigos. By subtracting an image of the brain when its owner is watching meaningless patterns or listening to meaningless sounds from an image when the owner is understanding words or speech, one can see which areas of the brain light up during language processing. The hot spots, as expected, are on the left side. What exactly is engaging the left hemisphere? It is not merely speech-like sounds or word-like shapes or movements of the mouth, but abstract language. Most aphasic people, Mr. Ford from Chapter 2, for example, can blow out candles and suck on straws, but their writing suffers as much as their speech. This shows that it is not mouth control but language control that is damaged. Some aphasics remain fine singers, and many are superb at swearing. In perception, it has long been known that tones are discriminated better when they are played to the left ear, which is connected most strongly to the right hemisphere. But this is only true if the tones are perceived as musical sounds like hums. When the ears are Chinese or Thai, and the same tones are features of phonemes, the advantage is to the right ear and the left hemisphere it feeds. If a person is asked to shadow someone else's speech, repeat it as the talker is talking, and simultaneously to tap a finger to the right or the left hand, the person has a harder time tapping with the right finger than with the left because the right finger competes with language for the resources of the left hemisphere. Remarkably, the psychologist Ursula Belugi and her colleagues have shown that the same thing happens when deaf people shadow one-handed signs in American Sign Language. They find it harder to tap with their right finger than with their left finger. The gestures must be tying up the left hemispheres, but it is not because they are gestures. It is because they are linguistic gestures. When a person, either a signer or a speaker, has to shadow a goodbye wave, a thumbs-up sign, or a meaningless gesticulation, the fingers of the right hand and the left hand are slowed down equally. The study of aphasia in the deaf leads to a similar conclusion. Deaf signers with damage to their left hemispheres suffer from forms of sign aphasia that are virtually identical to the aphasia of hearing victims with similar lesions. For example, Mr. Ford's sign language counterparts are unimpaired at non-linguistic tasks that place similar demands on the eyes and hands, such as gesturing, pantomiming, recognizing faces, and copying designs. Injuries to the right hemisphere of deaf signers produce the opposite pattern. They remain flawless at signing, but have difficulty performing visuospatial tasks, just like hearing patients with injured right hemispheres. It is a fascinating discovery. The right hemisphere is known to specialize in visuospatial abilities, so one might have expected that sign language, which depends on visuospatial abilities, would be computed in the right hemisphere. Belugi's findings show that language, whether by ear and mouth or by eye and hand, is controlled by the left hemisphere. The left hemisphere must be handling the abstract rules and trees underlying language, the grammar and the dictionary and the anatomy of words, and not merely the sounds and the mouthings at the surface. Why is language so lopsided? A better question is, why is the rest of a person so symmetrical? Symmetry is an inherently improbable arrangement of matter. If you were to fill in the squares of an 8x8 checkerboard at random, the odds are less than 1 in a billion that the pattern would be bilaterally symmetrical. The molecules of life are asymmetrical, as are most plants and many animals. Making a body bilaterally symmetrical is difficult and expensive. Symmetry is so demanding that among animals with a symmetrical design, any disease or weakness can disrupt it. As a result, organisms from scorpion flies to barn swallows to human beings find symmetry sexy, a sign of a fit potential mate, and gross asymmetry, a sign of deformity. There must be something in an animal's lifestyle that makes a symmetrical design worth its price. The crucial lifestyle feature is mobility. The species with bilaterally symmetrical body plans are the ones that are designed to move in straight lines. The reasons are obvious. A creature with an asymmetrical body would veer off in circles, and a creature with asymmetrical sense organs would eccentrically monitor one side of its body, even though equally interesting things can happen on either side. Though locomoting organisms are symmetrical side to side, they are not, apart from Dr. Doolittle's push-me-pull-you, symmetrical front and back. Thrusters apply force best in one direction, so it is easier to build a vehicle that can move in one direction and turn than a vehicle that can move equally well in forward and reverse, or that can scoot off in any direction at all, like a flying saucer. Organisms are not symmetrical up and down because gravity makes up different from down. The symmetry in sensory and motor organs is reflected in the brain, most of which, at least in non-humans, is dedicated to processing sensation and programming action. The brain is divided into maps of visual, auditory, and motor space that literally reproduce the structure of real space. If you move over a small amount in the brain, you would find neurons that correspond to a neighboring region of the world as the animal senses it. So a symmetrical body and a symmetrical perceptual world is controlled by a brain that is itself almost perfectly symmetrical. No biologist has explained why the left brain controls right space and vice versa. It took a psycholinguist, Marcel Kinsborn, to come up with the only speculation that is even remotely plausible. All bilaterally symmetrical invertebrates, worms, insects, and so on, have the more straightforward arrangement in which the left side of the central nervous system controls the left side of the body, and the right side controls the right side. Most likely, the invertebrate that was the ancestor of the chordates, animals with a stiffening rod around their spinal cords, including fish, amphibians, birds, reptiles, and mammals, had this arrangement as well. But all the chordates have contralateral control. Right brain controls left body, and left brain controls right body. What could have led to the rewiring? Here is Kinsborn's idea. Imagine that you are a creature with the left brain, left body arrangement. Now turn your head around to look behind you, a full 180 degrees back, like an owl. Stop at 180 degrees. Don't go around and around like the girl in The Exorcist. Now imagine that your head is stuck in that position. Your nerve cables have been given a half twist, so the left brain would control your right body and vice versa. Now, Kinsborn is not suggesting that some primordial rubbernecker literally got its head stuck, but that changes in the genetic instructions for building the creature resulted in the half twist during embryonic development, a torsion that one can actually see happening during the development of snails and some flies. This may sound like a perverse way to build an organism, but evolution does it all the time because it never works from a fresh drawing board, but has to tinker with what is already around. For example, our sadistically designed S-shaped spines are the product of bending and straightening the arched backbones of our quadrupedal forebears. The Picasso-esque face of the flounder was the product of warping the head of a kind of fish that had opted to cling sideways to the ocean floor, bringing around the eye that had been staring uselessly into the sand. Since Kinsborn's hypothetical creature left no fossils and has been extinct for over half a billion years, no one knows why it would have undergone the rotation. Perhaps one of its ancestors had changed its posture, like the flounder, and subsequently righted itself. Evolution, which has no foresight, may have put its head back into alignment with its body by giving the head another quarter twist in the same direction, rather than by the more sensible route of undergoing the original quarter twist. But it does not really matter. Kinsborn is only proposing that such a rotation must have taken place. He is not claiming he can reconstruct why it happened. In the case of the snail, where the rotation is accompanied by a bending, like one of the arms of a pretzel, scientists are more knowledgeable. As my old biology textbook explains, while the head and foot remain stationary, the visceral mass is rotated through an angle of 180 degrees, so that the anus is carried upward and finally comes to lie above the head. The advantages of this arrangement are clear enough in an animal that lives in a shell with only one opening. In support of the theory, Kinsborn notes that invertebrates have their main neural cables laid along their bellies and their hearts and their backs, whereas chordates have their neural cables laid along their backs and their hearts in their chests. This is exactly what one would expect from a 180-degree head-to-body turn in the transition from one group to the other, and Kinsborn could not find any reports of an animal that has only one or two out of the three reversals that his theory says must have happened together. Major changes in body architecture affect the entire design of the animal and can be very difficult to undo. We are the descendants of that twisted creature, and half a billion years later, a stroke in the left hemisphere leaves the right arm tingly. The benefits of a symmetrical body plan all have to do with sensing and moving in the bilaterally indifferent environment. For body systems that do not interact directly with the environment, the symmetrical blueprint can be overwritten. Internal organs such as the heart, liver, and stomach are good examples. They are not in contact with the layout of the external world, and they are grossly asymmetrical. The same thing happens on a much smaller scale in the microscopic circuitry of the brain. Think about the act of deliberately manipulating some captive object. The actions are not being keyed to the environment. The manipulator is putting the object anywhere it wants. So the organism's forelimbs and the brain centers controlling them do not have to be symmetrical in order to react to events appearing unpredictably on one side or the other. They can be tailored to whatever configuration is most efficient to carry out the action. Manipulating an object often benefits from a division of labor between the limbs, one holding the object, the other acting on it. The result is the asymmetrical claws of lobsters and the asymmetrical brains that control paws and hands in a variety of species. Humans are by far the most adept manipulators in the animal kingdom, and we are the species that displays the strongest and most consistent limb preference. 90% of people in all societies and periods in history are right-handed, and most are thought to possess one or two copies of a dominant gene that imposes the right-hand, left-brain bias. Possessors of two copies of the recessive version of the gene develop without this strong right-hand bias. They turn into the rest of the right-handers and into the left-handers and ambidextrix. Processing information that is spread out over time but not space is another function where symmetry serves no purpose. Given a certain amount of neural tissue necessary to perform such a function, it makes more sense to put it all in one place with short interconnections rather than have half of it communicate with the other half over a slow, noisy, long-distance connection between the hemispheres. Thus, the control of song is strongly lateralized in the left hemispheres of many birds, and the production and recognition of calls and squeaks is somewhat lateralized in monkeys, dolphins, and mice. Human language may have been concentrated in one hemisphere because it, too, is coordinated in time, but not environmental space. Words are strung together in order, but do not have to be aimed in various directions. Possibly, the hemisphere that already contained computational microcircuitry necessary for control of the fine, deliberate, sequential manipulation of captive objects was the most natural place in which to put language, which also requires sequential control. In the lineage leading to humans, that happened to be the left hemisphere. Many cognitive psychologists believe that a variety of mental processes requiring sequential coordination and arrangement of parts co-reside in the left hemisphere, such as recognizing and imagining multi-part objects and engaging in step-by-step logical reasoning. Gazzaniga, testing the two hemispheres of a split-brain patient separately, found that the newly isolated left hemisphere had the same IQ as the entire connected brain before surgery. Linguistically, most left-handers are not mirror images of the right majority. The left hemisphere controls language in virtually all right-handers, 97%, but the right hemisphere controls language in a minority of left-handers, only about 19%. The rest have language in the left hemisphere, 68%, or redundantly in both. In all of these lefties, language is more evenly distributed between the hemispheres than it is in righties, and thus the lefties are more likely to withstand a stroke on one side of the brain without suffering from aphasia. There is some evidence that left-handers, though better at mathematical, spatial, and artistic activities, are more susceptible to language impairment, dyslexia, and stuttering. Even righties with left-handed relatives, presumably those righties possessing only one copy of the dominant right bias gene, appear to parse sentences in subtly different ways than pure righties. Language, of course, does not use up the entire left half of the brain. Broca observed that Tan's brain was mushy and deformed in the regions immediately above the Sylvian fissure, the huge cleavage that separates the distinctively human temporal lobe from the rest of the brain. The area in which Tan's damage began is now called Broca's area, and several other anatomical regions hugging both sides of the Sylvian fissure affect language when they are damaged. In about 98% of the cases where brain damage leads to language problems, the damage is somewhere on the banks of the Sylvian fissure of the left hemisphere. Penfield found that most of the spots that disrupted language when he stimulated them were there too. Though the language areas appear to be separated by large gulfs, this may be an illusion. The cerebral cortex, gray matter, is a large sheet of two-dimensional tissue that has been wadded up to fit inside the spherical skull. Just as crumpling a newspaper can appear to scramble the pictures and text, a side view of the brain is a misleading picture of which regions are adjacent. Gazzaniga's co-workers have developed a technique that uses MRI pictures of brain slices to reconstruct what the person's cortex would look like if somehow it could be unwrinkled into a flat sheet. They found that all the areas that have been implicated in language are adjacent in one continuous territory. This region of the cortex, the left parasylvian region, can be considered to be the language organ. Let us zoom in closer. Tan and Mr. Ford, in whom Broca's area was damaged, suffered from a syndrome of slow, labored, ungrammatical speech called Broca's aphasia. Here is another example from a man called Peter Hogan. In the first passage, he describes what brought him into the hospital. In the second, his former job in a paper mill.
Dad and Peter Hogan and Dad, hospital, and, Wednesday. Wednesday, 9 o'clock, and, Thursday, 10 o'clock, doctors, two, and doctors and, teeth, yeah, and a doctor and girl, and gums, and eye, Lower Falls, Maine, paper, 400 tons a day, and, sulfur machines, and, wood. 2 weeks and 8 hours. 8 hours. No, 12 hours. 15 hours. Working. Yes, and, sulfur. Sulfur and, wood. Handling. And, sick, 4 years ago.
Broca's area is adjacent to the part of the motor control strip dedicated to the jaws, lip, and tongue, and it was once thought that Broca's area is involved in the production of language, though obviously not speech per se, because writing and signing are just as affected. But the area seems to be implicated in grammatical processing in general. A defect in grammar will be most obvious in the output, because any slip will lead to a sentence that is conspicuously defective. Comprehension, on the other hand, can often exploit the redundancy in speech to come up with sensible interpretations with little in the way of actual parsing. For example, one can understand, the dog bit the man, or the apple that the boy is eating is red, just by knowing that dogs bite men, boys eat apples, and apples are red. Even the car pushes the truck can be guessed at because the cause is mentioned before the effect. For a century, Broca's aphasics fooled neurologists by using shortcuts. Their trickery was finally unmasked when psycholinguists asked them to act out sentences that could be understood only by their syntax, like, the car is pushed by the truck, or the girl whom the boy is pushing is tall. The patients gave the correct interpretation half the time, and its opposite half the time. A mental coin flip. There are other reasons to believe that the front portion of the parasylvian cortex, where Broca's area is found, is involved in grammatical processing. When people read a sentence, electrodes pasted over the front of their left hemispheres pick up distinctive patterns of electrical activity at the point in the sentence at which it becomes ungrammatical. Those electrodes also pick up changes during the portions of a sentence in which a moved phrase must be held in memory, while the reader awaits its trace, like, what did you say, Trace, to John? Several studies using PET and other techniques to measure blood flow have shown that this region lights up when people listen to speech in a language they know,
tell stories, or understand complex sentences. Various control tasks and subtractions confirm that it is processing the structure of sentences, not just thinking about their content, that engages this general area. A recent and very carefully